Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about a subject that I don't think gets enough attention, which is why I started a radio show about it almost 2 years ago, and that is taste. And today we are triply excited, not just doubly, but triply excited to have with us in the studio someone who could easily be called the most important taste maker, perhaps, in the last few years. In fact, a recent art profile on David Chang in the current issue of Vogue magazine called him the king of the umami era. Ladies and gentlemen, he needs no introduction, really. David Chang, the king of Momofuku, really, and star of television, star of profiles everywhere, the curator of the upcoming MAD 3 conference in Copenhagen. Thank you for taking 30 minutes out of your life to be with us here in Heritage Radio.
Thank you for having me, Mitchell. Anything for you.
Oh, that's nice. I bet this isn't your first time in Roberta's, but it is your first time in Heritage Radio, right?
This is my first time in the studio, correct.
Cool. So I want to start. There are so many things we could talk about. In some ways, you're an open book, but of course, that's I think part of your charm and the reason that you've struck such a resonant chord among food lovers and chefs and really a global influence. But I want to talk to you about the most basic thing here. I want to talk about taste and this idea that you ushered in some way, or at least come to represent an umami era. Talk to me a little bit about how you would describe the food that you have become so associated with and what the flavor, why the flavor of it is so important to you.
I guess people that think that our flavors are really bold and exciting, I always think of, I don't get angry, but I feel like that gets pushed into like Tex-Mex.
Right. Like, hotter, right.
And for me, believe it or not, I'm always striving for something that's actually Japanese and subtle. And for me, it's clean flavors and clean and texture. And I feel that that's very Japanese. And at the core of what I love the most in terms of flavor is Japanese. So that's the basis for what people might want to call umami. But I don't really know.
Interesting. So your background, you're a Korean American. And
right.
You've sort of made kimchi a household word, which is just as improbable as perhaps sushi being a favorite food of Americans in some ways. Let's talk about kimchi. What would be a clean taste of kimchi?
I think you have obviously acidity is actually one thing that doesn't come to mind. Very, very important. And acidity, and kimchi is not all spicy, but it has that pungency comes from garlic and obviously the lacto fermentation, but it's very bright to me. Mm. And those are words probably most people would have described kimchi.
Right. Although it does describe the sort of excitement of eating your food, which is complicated, complex, but not muddled. Would you say that? Or is that what you're striving for?
Yeah.
Yeah. That would
I
be
guess.
Good.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's funny. I just read that Albert Adria piece or wherever it was. And he just basically said, you know, everything's fusion. And there's really only two types of cuisine, good food and bad food.
Okay.
And I think that's what we're striving for. We're striving for the former.
What proportion of the food you eat in the world in a day do you think is good food or versus bad food?
There's a lot of bad food out there.
Right.
It's a lot of bad food out there, which is why, which is funny why people think that. I think predominantly the past 20 years, good food and good taste were found only in fine dining restaurants.
Right.
And I think you find that a lot of people are trying to have this semantic discussion or argument of what is fine dining, because I think with the globalization of food and the awareness of food, people realize that where taste matters isn't in fine dining, but it's everywhere. So I think that we're in the process of figuring out what that is.
Indeed. And I would second that. I agree. Taste really does matter. And taste is different. I mean, we've been talking before we went on the air about your experiences in Canada. You now have restaurants in Australia, in Toronto, and here in New York, and you're expanding, I imagine, even farther afield, or at least milk bars are opening elsewhere. Is that what I hear?
Milk bars, and we're going to try to keep it domestic this year.
Okay. enough air miles.
No more. I mean, I thought, I was like, man, I'm flying just to collect air miles. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of.
Right. Especially if you don't have time to enjoy those air miles and go somewhere that is just fun. Although I think you bring some fun with you wherever you go, probably. But let's talk a little bit about what you think might be unique to sort of your approach to compare to some of the other places, either that you have restaurants, but I mean, you hang out with a global cadre of chef friends. And in the conversations there, what do you think makes your perspective uniquely American, if anything at all, or New York even?
I think that we're trying to look for flavor in all the wrong places. And I do feel that it's somewhat of a contrarian view, but if everyone thinks something tastes good, I want to find out what people don't taste good and see if there might be some hidden gold that's been overlooked. And that's sort of what I feel like is something that the best dishes, or the dishes that sort of resonate with not just the cooks, but with the audience that comes to our restaurants, they're usually eating something that has they've already tasted, but they've already maybe passed judgment on. Or
can you give me some examples? I'm just trying to what would be something that you would think wouldn't be good that you want to make part of the conversation or make relevant?
Let's see here.
Sorry, put you on the spot.
You know, right now we're, you know, obviously we've been fermenting so much, and we've been talking about fermentation at Momofuku forever, and that's the funny thing is, in a way, all of what we've been doing at the food lab in terms of finding and discovering taste, which is using these molds that have been around for literally almost a million years.
Mold as in growing organisms, not mold as in sort of a jello shapes.
But mold as in Aspergillus oryzae, right. Koji, and other molds and bacteria that make, when combined with food, create very delicious combinations. Because it's just everywhere. And that really has been the study of taste for us, is what is delicious. And that's what we've been studying. Literally, we could talk about taste forever. Then we were like, okay, let's sort of reverse engineer. What exactly is delicious? And I found that, for instance, when you talk about Thai food, people, it's salty, sweet, sour, bitter, right? It's delicious because that's those flavors are clear and predominant.
Right.
When you eat a French fry, why do people like it? Well, it's got some sweet, it's got some crunch, it's got some texture, it's salty, it's hot. It's usually something that's basic. And I feel that we were just trying to understand what makes something delicious. What makes a dry-aged steak delicious? What makes soy sauce delicious? And it's really umami for us. And we are trying to figure out, you know, I'm looking at like, we can look at, say, a plate of fava beans. Uh-huh. They're just sort of ending right now, but how can we make that into something that's more delicious than just what we already have? You have dried fava beans. Can we puree that, ferment it, fold in a little bit of percentage of Aspergillus oryzae, and turn fava bean? So the next season, we'll be able to create fava bean in a completely different way.
And be even more delicious.
More delicious.
It's so funny because as you're talking, I'm remembering experiences I have when I eat your food, mostly at Sambar, but anywhere. And you sit there and you think, you can almost see the process become more evident as you eat, because suddenly you hit a crunchy thing. And I imagine someone saying, we need something crunchy here. Or suddenly you hit something a little tart, that as you work through it, you sort of see the process of its creation, which is unlike a lot of eating experiences that you have around, where people sort of throw ideas sometimes without thinking, or sometimes things are delicious also. But it seems transparent in a good way, in a thoughtful way.
And that's what it is. If you might have had that dish 2 weeks before, and you might like, oh, this isn't very good. But we're sort of trusting our cooks and trusting each other that we're going to edit it along the way, and that so there's going to be this linear narration where we're going to document the mistakes and then we're going to try to make them better, because that's just what we can do. And trying to find that balance, I think acidity is something that is always lacking in food.
Interesting.
Almost always. And I don't really put that much acidity, but it's like you don't want to taste it, but it needs to be there. It's like I always view as acid in food as like the bass in a band. You don't really think the bass needs to be there, but once you take the bass out, you're like, I think something's missing.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's like when I listen to the White Stripes, I'm like, wow, I love it, but like, man, they could really use a bass player.
Or a squirt of lemon, maybe.
Right, a squirt of lemon juice.
Interesting. Well, it's funny because someone on Twitter this morning, Bun Lai, I don't know if you know him, he's a great sustainable sushi chef in New Haven, tweeted that the current issue of Scientific American is all about food. And in fact, when I read it this morning or started to read it, it was all about deliciousness and what makes something delicious. And I read about this experiment that made that I jotted down the details of because it made me think of you a little bit in anticipation of the show. It says, in one experiment, researchers connected volunteers' tongues to a low-voltage electrical device, showed them pictures of food items, and then sent a mild shock across their taste buds, a sensation not unlike licking a battery. The shock was supposed to impart a neutral taste, but asked afterwards to rate how pleasurable the shock was, those volunteers who saw photographs of sweet or fatty foods rated the stimulus far more pleasurable than those who saw a low-calorie food. And what they were trying to illustrate is that deliciousness is sort of environmental and has an ethos surrounding it that creates it. So there are obviously the chemical things that we perceive in the tongue, but your deliciousness, your form of, I think, expression has gone even beyond just the food itself. I know you like to say you focus only on the food, but you've tapped into something a little bit bigger, I think, that has really come to the attention of chefs everywhere who've been excited by the idea of approaching food and restaurants and cuisine in your way. And I'm going to ask you a little bit to describe what you think that, how you would describe that way, what you think it is. And maybe it's just a focus on the food, but I think it's a little bit more, no?
To me, it's always the taste or how somebody, whether you call it empathy or not. Like, I mean, I was talking to Rudy over at Sambar. It's like, you know, we just got the best crew and they really make everything happen. And the only reason I'm here is because they're here. They're right. Working.
Which must be a big change also, because from opening a sort of radical, I'm not going to play this game restaurant, the first one, right, to having an empire. And how many employees do you have now?
A lot.
In the hundreds, I imagine.
Yeah. And I'm learning how to manage my time and all that. And it's really hard because I just feel guilty all day long because I'm not anywhere. It doesn't feel like I'm anywhere, even though I feel like I'm working, but I'm not working. Anyway,
right.
This isn't a therapy session.
No.
We were talking about...
About beyond the food, what have you tapped into? What does the Momofuku mean?
I think you want to find value. I always think about there's only two things you can really experience when you leave a restaurant. You're either going to hate it or you're going to love it.
Really?
And you know, I don't want to be in the middle where you're like, that was my caloric intake for the day.
Right.
Job done. And obviously we want to shoot for, man, that was amazing. Mm-hmm. And whatever we need to do to get to that point, that's what we're going to try to do. And more often than not, we're probably going to fail. And it's within those failures, that's where the flavor lies.
We're going to come back to that because I think that's actually really key about sort of this bigger idea that I was talking about. But I want to remind people listening that you can actually call in if you're listening live to our show and ask Dave questions about anything, really, what we're talking about, but certainly anything else. The number here is 718-497-2128. You can also email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can tweet us your questions or comments at TasteMattersHRN. It's in the failure that flavor lies. I think that's a really brilliant statement, and I think that we should talk about that a little bit more because what it says to me is that the aspiration, the fact that you think that nothing is ever done, is part of what you guys have tapped into, the experience of excitement and discovery, that you don't just go once to one of your restaurants, but when you come back, it's a different thing. It's a different food, or the dishes have evolved.
Yeah, things grow. Ingredients change, staff changes, and things aren't stagnant. So if you have your goal to just sort of stay the same, you're going to regress. And we need to take the chance to grow. And that grow could potentially be taken 3 steps back.
Right.
But our goal is always to reach a goal that we're never going to reach. And, you know, it's maddening.
Right. I can imagine. Especially with more people that you're responsible for and have to also motivate and sort of bring along with you.
Right.
Right.
It's been very difficult.
Yeah.
Yes.
We're going to take a quick break. You are listening to Taste Matters. I'm talking with David Chang, who is the chef, owner, overseer, inspiration between the many Momofuku restaurants here in New York, the milk bars, the restaurants in Toronto, and a beautiful restaurant in Sydney, Australia. And you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to 4 of 7 by Jack Inslee on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from Taste Matters.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. You know, there's no more telling aspect, no more revealing virtue of a group of people having evolved in a lovely way than how they feed themselves, how they entertain, how they put food on the table, what they put on the table. Heritage Radio Network provides the clearest evidence that there's hope for us yet. Heritage Radio's like Fairway Market in that we both care deeply about what you're having for dinner tonight. Heritage Radio Network is not just about food, though. Every time I tune in, I learn something about things other than food, too. Architecture, design, stuff like that. But from where I stand, I still say, if you can't eat it, what's the point? For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, I think we should hold down the tables or Steve Jenkins might eat them. that was fun. We're back in the studio at Heritage Radio Network with Dave Chang, and we are talking about taste. And I want, now that you have had experience outside New York, which many of us, myself included sometimes, thinks is the greatest food city in the world, but you've now spent lots of time in Sydney and in Toronto, I wonder if you have any thoughts about New York or those other places and how they rate and how they're different, I guess, because, you know, we all kind of look the same. Some of us talk with funny accents, but what are your impressions now that you're outside your native
habitat? Just because we speak English doesn't mean that anything is the same.
Okay.
And culturally speaking, everything is very different. Australia couldn't be more different than America. There are some similarities that Australia has with Canada, but again, the weather changes that. And Canada, very different place. And I understand why Canadians never want to be compared to Americans. Much better now.
And food-wise? I mean, obviously, your restaurants have been well-received in both places, but have you had to change a little bit?
You know, it's different. The first thing I found is water is harder in Australia.
Oh, interesting.
So that interacts with flour differently. So when we bake something, the recipes are a little bit off. Butter is different in Australia because the importation laws are very strict. So you always have this sort of taste of powdered milk in a lot of your dairy.
Oh.
Canadian butter is much better. Dairy is much better. But obviously it's harder to get seafood. But you get British right. Columbia and you have Nova Scotia, so it's there.
But they're far away.
They're far away, and getting it. There are some amazing farmers in Canada, but the network in terms of how to get literally farm to table, there are a lot of trucks and flights involved, and it's not quite there yet.
Yeah,
no. It's going to be there. It's there. I see it.
Well, you've only got 33 million people in a place bigger than the United States.
There's, right.
Yeah, it's tough.
And one other thing I can definitely say in terms of taste is salt intake is less. I think in terms of when I season something or when I taste something, things are a little bit less salty. Just like in Japan, like when I was working in Japan, everything that I made was too salty and I had to sort of retrain my palate. And then when I came back to New York to cook, everything was under season.
You've just justified my sister, who always complains when she comes and eats here that everything from Toronto, that everything is so salty here. Right. She doesn't know how we stand it. How interesting.
And it's a little bit less in Canada, a little bit less in Sydney. And not that anything's wrong. It's just the environment that you're in. And then particularly Japan, that's when I knew, like, wait a second, like, my palate is totally screwed.
What is it? I mean, I'm going to talk about Japan, which is one of my favorite subjects. And as listeners know, we recently came back from a couple of weeks there. What is it? What do you think we could learn from Japan as a food culture in New York specifically? I'm thinking New York versus Tokyo. I watched your Mind of the Chef recently, the ramen show, where you were just going nuts over at Tsukemon.
Yeah, Rokurinsha ramen. That is just the best.
We have great ramen here. You make great ramen. We have great. Actually, I think one of the things we excel at is Japanese food and some the access we have to some Japanese food. But it's still different, and the clientele is different. What are your thoughts about Japan?
I think product, they get the best product. Mm. Obviously, seafood is unparalleled, but people underestimate the vegetables. I don't think that they understand just how great the fruits and vegetables are in Japan. Right. Even tomatoes, whether it comes from like a Kyushu island or again, like when I was in Kyoto recently, I had the best strawberry I ever had in my life.
Wow.
And it was in the winter in the mountains. And they've been farming for 1,000 years. I met a farmer that worked for 1,000 years. He's a 14th generation farmer in his family. And they've been working side by side with a couple restaurants that have been around for 1,000 years. Wow. So they have something, a history of food and taste and understanding of taste that we can't even fathom.
No. And lately I've had this sense, and I wonder what your thoughts are, that although on the production side, the chefs, the growers, the artisans who make food have, I mean, some of the quality we get here is just world-class, outstanding, amazing. Diners have a little work to do to come meet that. And in Japan, you just see such a culture of connoisseurship and appreciation that I think must motivate the chefs to be even better.
People are food nerds in Japan.
Yeah.
Everybody knows. Because everybody knows what's in season.
Right.
They take seasonality very seriously.
They even change the dishes.
Four distinct seasons. And monthly, the seasons are different, obviously. So everybody knows what fish is supposed to be on the menu and which is the best. So just general food knowledge is much higher in Japan. And, you know, they've been, I'd argue French food is better in Japan, or even Italian food is better in Japan than those respective countries, because they've been sending cooks to those countries for the past 50 years.
Right.
And bringing back the best. And so they've been curating all of these tastes. And
as a chef, what part of your job or your role do you see as an educator? Or are you really just there to sort of educate yourself and your staff, or help your clientele know more, figure out things? Do you think that's a part of your job?
I think part of our job as cooks, and at least at our restaurant, is to be as knowledgeable as possible and to constantly question.
And to convey that at all, or not even? That's just for you, to produce the tastiest thing you can.
It's to convey that at some point. And going back to fermentation and taste, that's really what we're doing is, believe it or not, I believe an outgrowth of what Heston and Ferran and that modernist movement did was really question why something is the way it is. Why does something taste the way it does? Why do we have to do anything at all? And let's understand it a little bit better. So for us, how could we understand something on the most basic level?
Right.
And that for us was fermentation and asking the question of why. And trying to educate that to our staff, and then trying to create a product that people are going to like, and understanding flavors and isolating flavors and having that sort of trickle down to the customers is the eventual goal. But education is paramount.
So pardon me, you left me speechless. It's so in choosing to do a restaurant, I mean, I don't know if you have a new one or a book, or even, we didn't even mention Lucky Peach, which is sort of a game-changing magazine, if only because, like your restaurants, you sort of are doing what you want to do and figuring it out and failing and trying to do better the next time in a way that I think really almost taps into this DIY moment we're in, because it shows a a vulnerability that you don't often expect from someone, quite frankly, as renowned and famous for you. Do you think that putting yourself out there in these ways and all these different places changes the experience that people have when they come to your thing? Or is it really just about the what's on the plate and you just hope they have a good time and like the music and leave and come back?
I'm trying hard to show that I actually do nothing, and that that it really is the respective chefs at all the restaurants and the cooks, and I'm trying better to improve my relationship and learning how to communicate better within the cooks and the relationships between the restaurants all over the world now. So, and running a magazine, so it's a you know, I wouldn't say I'm a bit at a crossroads, but I'm learning how to do things that I never knew how to do before.
Right. And they're hard. They're almost harder than cooking something delicious.
Yeah.
Different.
But, you know, now we have more talented people than ever before, and it's in my way to put them in positions to be as successful as possible. And so, we're very fortunate in that regard.
One of the things I remember Danny Meyer saying when people asked him why he kept opening restaurants, and he said, I mean, partly obviously there was a desire to do something else, but also he had really good people he wanted to do something for, not lose or help grow. And so the natural thing would be to open another restaurant and give someone else an opportunity. Do you feel that sort of pressure?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting. I think a lot of people today want to open up a small restaurant or don't want to open up a restaurant at all. So the culinary game is completely different. I don't understand it. I think that we're in a very strange, peculiar time right now.
Say more about that. You've just come from shooting a Top Chef Canada show.
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about that.
You've had your own TV show.
Yeah, food is weird right now, and I think that it's better than it's ever been and also worse than it's ever been at the same time.
Say a couple of examples of the better and a couple of examples of the worse. I mean, obviously, we can...
People are eating better. Yeah. As much as I can complain about it, you can go to any restaurant and feel, and the quality across the board has gotten better. But because that has happened, there are less people that there are less restaurants that are that can stand out amongst that crowd.
Right.
So we're never going to see a L'Espanasse again. We're never going to see Per Se open up again. We're never going to see somebody. Was sort of before my time. We're never going to see somebody try to open up a Quilted Giraffe just on a whim. Wow. Be like, you know, let's try to do that.
So say a little bit more, because I think that's really interesting. And what did it mean to open those places in that time? Because they were iconic and there was nothing
new.
Like it. New, right?
Nobody had seen anything that like that before. You never had people forget just, yeah, I definitely state that David Boulay is by far and away the greatest chef America's ever produced.
Wow.
And nobody knows just how much he's done and how many cooks have come through his kitchens. You're never going to see another David Boulay again, somebody that sort of redefined what French cooking was for Americans.
Mm.
And because it was all new, anything seemed possible. And now you can just read about it and imagine, close your eyes on the internet, what it might taste like.
Right. The cronut, I guess, is an example of something faster than a virus. I mean, it was a virus. It's in Tokyo, they were talking about cronuts when I was there just a few weeks ago.
And it's strange because while that's happening, I think some craftsmanship and artisanship is being lost. And, you know, somewhere along the way in my own self-loathing, I see, you know, Momofuku being part of the good and the bad in this process. So, I don't know. You know, at the same time, the internet has been really great and terrible for food too. So I think that has all. I mean, if we want to talk about taste, I think the internet has fundamentally changed how we perceive flavors and taste
because it's exposed us to so much happening all at the same.
So
second.
You can read about anything, now.
Right?
You know, like
and then a zap on the tongue from an electric shock and you just think you've just had it or
think
something.
Think about how much that changed. Like in the 90s or even late 80s, Gray Kuntz and Jean-Georges had to go to Southeast Asia after apprenticing under the greatest chefs in Europe to go learn what a jackfruit tasted like or what kaffir lime actually tasted like.
Right.
And to learn. Now you can – there's little incentive now to do that. You can just read about it on the internet and order it online.
Right. It's amazing. And it, as you say that, the other thing I find is amazing is most of the people listening to us right now probably have no idea who Greg Koons is or was. And that's a little sad in some ways. Do you ever think about that? What your mark is going to be?
No, those guys, those guys are on Mount Rushmore. And, or even Christian Deluvier, and the list goes on and on. Like, I'm a classicist at heart, and the only reason why I love those guys. And, those are the types of chefs that I admire and will continue to admire. And the only reason I'm here is because they did what they did.
Right. But I also think that people will say the same about you one day because you gave them a job and you screamed your head off at them and suddenly they saw something in a different way and inspired them to go on.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's hope so, because I actually think something new will come along and it'll all be delicious.
That'll be a cultural low point for everybody.
Well, and on that high point of the conversation, I want to thank you so much, Dave, for coming in. I know you're a busy guy. You're on your way to Copenhagen imminently, I imagine.
Correct.
For Mad 3, which you can all follow along with on the internets. And next week, so thank you for being here and thank you for taking the time. Thank you for having me, Mitchell. Next week, we are going to welcome Peter Guzzi. It was funny to hear Steve Jenkins talk about how on the station we talk to architects about design, because he is a great restaurant designer who is, among other things, responsible for both Blue Hill restaurants. And we're going to have an interesting conversation with him about the influence of space on taste. Until then, why don't you throw a stone and hit a Momofuku restaurant out your door somewhere, or at least have a piece of crack pie or a compost cookie, and think about just the thoughts that went into making it as delicious as it is, and maybe you have some suggestions to make it even more so. You're listening to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis. Thanks. Be delicious.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.